Welcome, baseball fans, to episode 33 of the Nats GM Show, the only podcast available via the Nats GM Radio Network. I am your host, Ryan Sullivan, the chairman of NatsGM.com and the baron of all baseball podcasts. Before we are joined by this week's special guest, I would like to briefly mention our sponsor, Amazon.com. If you want to help support this podcast, go to NatsGM.com, click on the Amazon link on the right side of the page, and do your online shopping. One more quick favor, if I might, please rate and review this podcast on iTunes, as this helps us gather additional listeners to the show.
This is Jason Parks from Baseball Prospectus, and you're listening to the Nats GM Show.
And now I am honored to have back on the show Josh Kuznick, a MLB certified player agent, a writer for Baseball Prospectus, and also celebrating a birthday today. So let's start at the top. Happy birthday, Josh.
Thank you very much. I'm old.
Well, I'm older than you are, so you got that going for you, so you can taunt me about that. But
I don't think I'll be catching up anytime soon, so at least there's that.
So you got that going for you, which is nice.
But
Josh, welcome back to the show. It's great to have you on. You are our favorite agent, and the response was huge when we had you on a couple of months ago, and I'm just glad to have you back on.
Yeah, that's great. I had fun, so I like these, and figured what better way to spend my birthday than talking about baseball.
Yeah, so that's, first of all, that's very appreciated. So first place I wanted to start, and I actually had somebody write me this question and said, you didn't cover this in the first interview, and I don't know how I didn't, but what are the duties and obligations of an agent for your player besides, I mean, I think we all know that you're, you know, negotiating a contract, but beyond that, you know, what else are you doing for your players?
There's a lot of support elements that go into it. You know, you have to keep up with how your players are doing. You're the player's voice to the organization, so they don't have to talk to the club. You know, you're essentially the representative, and that kind of speaks for itself, obviously, but you have to really focus in on how your players are doing, keep up with that, stay in touch with them, work on the marketing side of things. So endorsements are a big part of what I do, especially while they're in the minor leagues, and really just be an advocate for them. I think that would be the best word for what it is that I do, is really be an advocate for my players and always look out for what's in their best interest on and off the field.
And something you said just caught my ear is you said in the minor leagues, getting those dollars is so important. What happens at the major leagues? Is it just not as much of a negotiation because they are in the big leagues?
It's funny. In big leagues, it's like, here's free money. And in the minor leagues, it's a lot more advocating. When they need the money in the minor leagues, they don't usually hand it out. And when you don't need it when you're in the big leagues, they give you more of it than you'll ever need. So it's a little bit different process at the major league level. It's a little bit more smooth.
Yeah, well, that makes. I guess that sounds about right. Is there any crazy story that you've had? Somebody asking you something just bizarre to take care of?
I had a player get catfished once. That was an awesome story.
What?
Out of baseball now. Yeah, it really pissed me off. I was representing this kid. He was an undrafted free agent. I actually have never met him. He was a referral from a client. He was a roommate of one of my players, and said that he was a really good kid and he was an undrafted free agent and needed an agent. I said I'd meet him in spring training, and I really liked him, and I helped him out, you know, and then nice enough kid, and I wasn't really his agent per se, but I was helping him out until I met him and was able to scout him, obviously, but he had good numbers, and I didn't mind helping out in the meantime, so until I could meet him in spring training. And one night he blew up my phone at like 4 a.m, and he literally got catfished, and I mean, and it was so stupid. You know, the area code was from Wisconsin, but he thought it was a stripper from L.A., and He sent all these horrible pictures to her, and she threatened to like blackmail him and ruin his life because he called her out on it. So she ended up putting on Instagram and Twitter all these horrible pictures of him, claiming he was gay, which he was not. And it was really bad. So like, at 3 in the morning, if you were to go on Instagram and hashtag Nats, the first thing to come up were naked pictures of this guy. So,
God.
So I had to call Twitter and email them like 100 times. Like, I flagged it 100 times and called them, and I told them to call the authorities, and the pictures were taken down by 6 a.m., and the Mets never found out, and he's out of baseball now, so I have no problem talking about the team. But it was not a good situation. This was years ago, but good God almighty, what are you doing?
That's really the call you want at 4 a.m. I got catfished. That's really
by no offense, and I try not to play favorites. You really don't want to hear that call from anyone. You especially don't want to hear it from a guy in the New York 10 league.
Right, yeah, that's a good point.
You know, I tell everybody when I sign them, I'm like, look, man, everybody gets one. It's like Spider-Man. You know, everyone gets one. And after that, I was so pissed off, I stopped working for him.
Yeah, that just might have been the straw that broke that camel's back.
Yeah, I took care of it. I mean, I didn't leave him hanging, but I quit after that. I'm like, I'm done. I don't want any part of this anymore.
Just brush those hands. That deal, yeah, no kidding. God.
So that was the interesting story.
That's I don't even know how to transition off that. That's amazing. That's so great.
Yeah, there's not a good transition. I don't think you were expecting that story.
No, I was not. That definitely was not told to me off air. So let me change to another story, but another great story. Probably not quite as amusing, but a happy ending. You wrote a couple of months ago about Jim Miller, kind of a veteran pitcher that I think, you know, a lot of the baseball fans have known or at least recognized the name and so forth. It was a great story. I'd just love for you to share it for those of us, you know, or those who are listening that didn't hear it. And I'd love to just get a little update on how he's doing.
That was awesome. I'd really never experienced anything like that before. Jim had had an agent for 11 years that he was happy with. And he was aggravated that he wasn't signed going into February. And he was friends with one of my clients. He asked my client at the time, who had signed a contract before him, if he could talk to me. So my client called me and asked if I talked to Miller. I said, sure. I spoke to him, heard what he had to say, and I liked him, but I advised him not to switch agents because he's been with this guy for 11 years and they seem to have a good relationship. And it was unfortunate because it seemed like they were trying really hard to get him work. It just was ineffective for one reason or another. And it came to a head kind of a day or two later, and I just told them, you know, it sucked, but I told them it was probably best that, you know, he let me take over, and I did. And 9 days later, he got a big league invite with Tampa, and that was cool. And he pitched well in spring. He had 9 2/3 scoreless this spring in big league camp. Went down to AAA and was probably a day away from getting called up and getting added to the roster, but he had an implosion one game where he gave up a bunch of runs and kind of messed up his ERA, but I think the last outing he threw 3 2/3 scoreless, and I still think he has a good shot of getting back up there this year at least at some point. I love Jim. He's one of my favorite guys, and it feels like I've represented him for years. He's a really good dude and good family man, and I really like him, so I'm happy to be helping him out.
And are you going to help him going forward? I mean, are you guys clients and working together?
Oh, yeah. I'm his agent. So, yeah, I'm his agent. So, yeah, I've helped him with marketing stuff and dealing with the team. And, you know, I fielded calls from Asia seeing if there was anything there. So, you know, if there's an opportunity there, the Rays know the deal and it's in a contract. So, I mean, if it doesn't work out in Tampa then, and it worked out overseas, it's something he'd obviously consider, I would imagine. So, I'm handling all that now for Jim.
And I know you can't talk about the work that the agency was doing beforehand, but is it more in the sometimes just another voice approaching a team or just talking to a general manager? Or maybe you can't go there, and I understand that.
No, I did a good job. I believe it at that.
Okay, and that's fair enough.
I don't think it was a different voice. I just think I did a really good job, all modesty aside.
Well, I'll give it to you. That's a good job. So, the next topic I wanted to bring up with you, you've written about it a fair amount at Baseball Prospectus, and autograph collecting. I'm a big autograph collector. I've kind of grown up with it. I'm not obsessive. I understand, you know, I'm an adult. I don't like to, you know, be too crazy. But I'd love to hear from the agent side how you talk to your players about it and kind of how you've seen it evolve. I know you grew up kind of collecting autographs as well.
Oh, yeah. I my first business was selling autographs. I went to my early games when I was 14, and I got Scott Rolen and Nomar Garciaparra and Vladimir Guerrero signed a bunch of stuff for me, and that was when I fell in love with baseball, really. And I started going to Florida State League games with my dad, from 96 on, and eventually bled into starting a sports agency, which worked out okay. And, I'm sad about the hobby. I it sucks. You know, I berated someone the other day on Facebook about it, which, I don't know if that was smart or not, but, I'll leave it indifferent, but it's, the hobby's disgusting to me now. I'm just thoroughly disgusted with it. You know, I love fans. I like baseball fans. I don't like dealers. They screw it up for kids. They screw it up for fans. And I really, it's tricky for me because I've been on both sides of the coin, but the way collectors are now, you know, quote unquote, the diehard collectors, the ones with the notebooks and the 8 different pens and the methodical system, I don't like them. It's a personal thing just because I don't think they handle it well as a whole. You know, I know it's generalizing. I mean, there are good ones out there for sure, but, you know, one of the things that I talked to Sam Miller about the other day, and I'm debating whether or not to rant about it in the column. I don't know if it deserves its own column. It might, but, you know, I don't want to bite the hand that feeds, but one of the most disgusting, disturbing trends there are is that, you know, there are high school baseball cards now, and that just pisses me off. You know, Leaf Trading Card makes the perfect game set, and Upper Deck makes the Team USA set. I actually have less of a problem with the USA set because that's been done since the 80s.
Sure.
But the thing that is upsetting to me is what's different about what they're doing now versus making the cards is that they're making, and this is true with the Aflac game as well, and I believe Under Armour, they're making the kids sign the cards or else they can't participate in the event. So they're forcing them to sign autographs without compensating them because they can't compensate them because then they lose their amateur status. So these kids are signing autographs for these companies for free. The companies are selling them, and it's terrible. Like, that's an awful thing. If I had a kid who was at one of those events, I would never let them sign for a company and then have the company sell them. And, you know, and the argument against it is, oh, well, the companies are, you know, sponsoring the event. It's like, well, those events existed before these cards existed. So
of course.
I don't buy that. And the thing that really upsets me is that obviously not every card is autographed. You know, you get 10 autographs per box in the Leaf Perfect Game Set, I believe. And then there's a bunch of unautographed cards. And what it does is it gives incentive for these autograph collectors that I personally find to be creepy as hell. They travel to high schools to get high school kids to sign autographs, and it really just pisses me off. So there was one collector online the other day who had posted that he had met an Aflac kid. He drove 3 states to get an Aflac kid, and he showed that he got like 5 photos and a baseball card and a baseball signed by Jameis Winston while he was in high school as a baseball player. And I chewed him out. And he's like, he's 18 years old, he's a grown man. I'm like, no, this is a kid who's getting ready for prom, who lived at home with his parents, and should not have a baseball card. Like, no. Like, that's a line being crossed, and I'm uncomfortable with that. So I don't like that trend of people getting high school autographs. I remember back in, like, 08 when Nieto went to Aflac, people had him sign photos. They ended up on eBay. They're still on eBay. And I don't like any of that. I don't like that people are going up to 16, 17-year-old high school games and getting autographs. And their justification is that, oh, you know, I paid for my ticket to the game. It supports the school. And what kid wouldn't love to sign? And I'm like, yeah, try going to a high school baseball game and cheering for somebody else's kid and not asking for an autograph and see how that goes.
Yeah, exactly.
But I just think it's creepy. And then the counter-argument that people have given me is like, well, you're an agent. You know, what's the difference of you talking to a parent of a 16-year-old and trying to represent them? And that's a fair argument, but my answer is I don't do that because I think that's creepy.
Well, and you're also, at the end of the day, trying to help. I mean, yeah, you're going to make money, but you're trying to help the young man, whereas the autograph guy has no interest in helping him. He just wants to make pure profit, which is...
Or add to his collection, which there are some people that go to high school games to collect them before they're famous, and that's... That's their hobby.
And that does go into my next kind of question is where does that line fall? Because, you know, I'm 34 years old, so it is a little odd for me to go to a 20, not even a high school kid, but a, you know, a minor leaguer and ask for an autograph. I mean, they're 10 years younger than I am.
I don't mind that as much. I really don't. If a guy has a baseball card and you want to go to a game and get it signed, that's part of the deal. I don't have a problem with that. All my guys sign autographs, but it's all in moderation. I mean, I give them. I don't tell anyone what to do. I let them know how the industry is. I let them know all about the way that the dealers are. I let them know about how collectors are. And, you know, guys trade everywhere. And, you know, the one, collectors, you know, universally, which is awkward for me because, you know, I still collect autographs. I don't ask for baseball autographs because I haven't asked for a baseball autograph in 13, 14 years of a current player. But so when I was in the hospital, I was writing letters to retired players, and I very rarely do I have free time. But when I do, I enjoy writing two or three letters to guys who played in the 40s and 50s. I stay in touch with guys like that, you know, guys like Bobby Shantz, Wally Westlake, Bobby Doerr. I always like stuff like that. I've been doing that since I was a kid. That stuff's always been fun to me, doing it through the mail and talking to the retired guys. But going to minor league games and getting autographs now is such a business, or even the collectors. And the thing I mean, I vehemently hate it amongst autograph collectors I message for. There are threads dedicated to how awful. I mean, I was called an enemy of the hobby a month ago by a collector. I mean, that's how insane these people are. And the part that gets lost on them, they're like, we don't sell it. You know, we pay a ticket to the game. I'm like, this entitles you to nothing, you know. And the entitlement is what bothers me. And the not taking no for an answer pisses me off. But long story short is I tried to use the George Carlin quote, hobbies cost money, interests are free, and I don't care if you're not selling them. If it's something that you're collecting and it's your hobby, you know, you have to pay for it, in my opinion. And if a player signs for you and is gracious enough to sign for you, then be happy with it. If it's not exactly the way you want it, too bad. You didn't pay for it. If you want it the way you want it, pay for it. And I got two angry emails from fans after the Portland Sea Dog opening banquet. One of my clients, Carlos Asuaje, he signs autographs every single day, and he personalizes all of them, and he does it in a way that you can't erase the personalization because collectors hate their cards personalized as a whole. So they take nail polish remover and eraser and erase the personalization. So Carlos personalizes it in a way that his autograph touches the personalization. It's called looping in the hobby. And I got two angry emails from collectors, quote unquote, saying, you know, I met your client, Carlos Asuaje. He asked my name. He looped the autographs, and I'm really pissed off that he did that. And I said, you've got to be kidding me. You took time out of your life to email his agent because I'm accessible, because it's me.
Right.
Tell me you're mad about my guy who actually signed for you. Are you kidding me?
Yeah, and was nice enough to personalize it and was gracious enough to sign. Yeah, exactly.
So I get complaints from people about that, but it's only the quote-unquote collectors. It's only them. It's never the fans. It's never, you know, the kids. It's never the people that enjoy baseball for baseball's sake. It's always the diehards that have the backpacks. It's like the kids who go, you know, the teenagers who go to the game early to try to get 300 foul balls. It's like those guys. And I don't care what those people think. And I've had guys institute autograph policies where they'll sign one thing per person, which is how I believe it should be. I tell all my players, if somebody hands you five baseball cards, sign one. If somebody, you know, hands you five baseballs, sign one. If somebody hands you a baseball and a card, sign both of them. But, you know, somebody hands you, you know, I've seen it, you know, somebody tried to hand one of my clients 40 cards in one shot. It's like, screw you.
Yeah, I saw that the other day with a player. They handed
them. On the flip side of that, though, in the hypocrisy department, when I was 16, I used to hand players hundreds of cards, so I did it too.
So then the final question I want to ask on this topic is, let's go to the fan. You know, I consider myself a fan, and let's take maybe myself out of the equation, but, you know, a kid or, you know, 13, 15-year-old, whatever. What advice do you have them going up to the player? I mean, you've asked for hundreds of autographs, and now you've got the other side. What advice would you give?
I mean, if you go up to a minor league player and you ask them their name, you know, or, like, you know, definitely say please and thank you. Ask them their name. You know, if you're a casual fan, that should be the whole exchange. You know, most of my guys personalize their items because they want to have a good interaction with the fan. especially with kids. You know, if a player asked me my name when I was a kid, the encounter would be more memorable than just scribbling an autograph. So my players usually personalize and are pretty nice about it as a whole. The children especially, they're nice to all of them. But the adults tend to get angry at it. I mean, I remember at the Florida State League All-Star game last year, there was a guy who brought six, like, 10-year-old girls with him to get baseball bats signed by the whole team and was just there to sell them, and it pissed me off. And you see that a lot now. And so, you know, if you're a casual fan, just be nice. You know, the players are human. Just ask their name, ask how their day's going. And if you're, you know, if you have a baseball card you bring with you and you're a little bit more hardcore, you know, read the back of the baseball card and ask the guy about his college, ask him about his day. You know, don't just say, hey, here, sign this. You know, say please, say thank you. And if a guy tells you, no, I can't sign, or, you know, he signs one, and, you know, don't ask him to sign five. If you find one, just take what you get and be happy. You know, that's the thing I don't like is, I've been to games where, you know, a guy will have out nine cards, player will sign one, some guys will sign three, and then the fan will, or collector will say, can you get the rest of them? And, like, the player stopped for a reason. What is wrong with you?
Yeah, that's true. What are your thoughts on asking, like, the pitchers who are charting the game, you know, in a minor league game? Because I see that all the time.
I get annoyed with that because they're working, but, you know, if it's like a kid who has a baseball and he realizes it's a player, that's harmless. If it's a guy who's got 10 baseball cards, they're just either dealers or they're collectors. And the collector's argument, which always pisses me off, is that, you know, oh, it's not worth anything. I'm like, well, if it's not worth anything, what are you doing?
Yeah, why are you wasting your time? Yeah.
Yeah, like, if it's not worth anything, what in God's name are you doing? And that's the argument I get from everybody. You know, oh, it's not worth anything. Or, you know, the other thing in the hobby, you know, the hobby community that I've noticed, which has always angered me. I can't tell you how many times people told me Michael Brantley sucked because he didn't sign 100 things per person while he's coming up through the minor league. So based on how willing a player is to sign, or based on their willingness to sign autographs, is how they dictate the player's ability. So if a guy signs a ton, he's a wonderful player. If a guy doesn't sign a bunch of autographs, he's a jerk and sucks. So it's been like that forever. I mean, it happened when I was a kid. I mean, I remember guys being jerks to me, and it sucked. But, you know, that's part of the fun. You know, if there weren't difficult autographs to get, everybody signed everything, the hobby would be boring. But, I mean, that's not why I do it. You know, I always try to preserve the guy's value of their autograph while at the same time being gracious and nice to everyone who asks. But, you know, that privilege can be abused, you know. And it's not a right getting an autograph. It's certainly a privilege, and on both sides. For the player to be signing is a privilege, and for the guy to be asking to get one is a privilege. So, you know, I got into a fight with somebody this spring training who told me that Michael Brantley made a 9-year-old kid cry. And I'm like, no, he didn't. That never happened. I didn't even need to be there to know that did happen. He's like, no, it was Michael Brantley was his favorite player. And Mike walked right past him and didn't sign anything for him. And then he started crying, and then a bunch of other players signed for him. Like, this is the most unbelievable story I've ever heard in my life. And then I thought about it, and I'm like, wait a second. When did this happen? He goes, last year. I'm like, okay, did it happen at the field, or was the kid waiting at the hotel with his dad at 2 a.m? He goes, oh, this was at the hotel. And I'm like, oh, yeah. Well, there you go. Mike doesn't sign at hotels.
Right.
And he's like, well, the kid was a fan. And I'm like, what is a 9-year-old doing at the team hotel at, you know, 1 a.m?
Yeah, exactly.
So, I, you know, maybe the kid was sad, but that's the father's fault for bringing him there at 1 a.m.
Yeah, and I completely agree. Take him to the ballpark at 5, and he gets the autograph.
Yes, exactly. And Mike signs for fans. You know, it's difficult because there's a huge crowd and a high demand, but, you know, they sign. And, God, there was one other, you know, the Orioles have a policy now where they're not allowed to sign at the team hotel, because the people who were waiting at the team hotel nearly killed one of the player's kids. They bumped, it was a player, his wife, and his two children, and the collectors bumped one of the kids in the street, and the kid nearly got run over by a cab. So the front office instituted a no autograph policy at the hotel, or they get fined now. And I don't think any player should ever sign autographs at the hotel. That just enables, you know, an invasion of personal space, and I very much look down on that. When I was a kid, when I was a teenager, I did that all the time. In retrospect, awful decision.
Yeah, I tend to agree. If you're actually at the hotel just, you know, visiting or whatever, and you run into a player, it's one thing. But to be staking them out is...
Yeah, if you're on a business trip or you're on vacation and you run into somebody, and you get a napkin or whatever. Like, I ran into Michael Phelps and Shaq once when I was, you know, younger, and they sent napkins for me. You know, that's one thing. If you're waiting there at 2 a.m. for the bus, you know, and you don't get an autograph, screw you. I don't care. You know, you're at the hotel, you're bothering them. You know, if they want to sign, that's their business. If they don't want to sign, they don't owe you anything. And you're most certainly invading their family time. And the vast majority of people who go to hotels are dealers. I don't care what anyone tells me.
Yeah, if you're shady enough to look up where they're staying, you've definitely got an alternate agenda. So, and it's just...
I mean, I've seen people call players' hotel rooms asking them to come down to sign. That happens.
Oh, my gosh. I mean, that's just amazing to me.
It's awful. A hobby, since I stopped collecting when I was a kid, it is degraded so badly. It's awful. And all these collectors share their signing habits on the internet about who signs, who doesn't, how many they sign, what they're willing to sign. And it's this club of just people. And I hate to classify everyone as the same, but like I said, if you don't have any qualms going to Perfect Game and bothering a bunch of 16-year-olds, I just think that's creepy. That's personal opinion. I just think it's creepy. I don't think they should have baseball cards. I don't think they should be forced into signing. And I just think it's creepy if you're going to high school games. And there's some collectors out there that one of their goals is to get, and it's a cool, neat thing, but one of the goals is to get an autograph from every single player drafted. So, like, you know, they make a list or a binder of 1,200 players, you know, whether it's the first round or the 40th, and they want to get one autograph on a baseball card or an index card of every single player, which is a cool project. I think that's cool. I would have loved to have thought of that when I was a kid. But the problem is instead of waiting until they're professionals, all of them, because some of them go to college, they will harass them in college.
Yeah.
And it's like, come on.
Yeah, I know. And just kind of to wrap up the whole topic, it's a shame because it's ruined it for people like me who are 34 years old and just want to get a baseball from, you know, hey, I had somebody on a podcast. It'd be neat to have a baseball signed by them. And then they give me these cross-eyed looks like, are you going to sell this? Is this going to be on eBay? And it's the whole thing's a shame. It really is.
Yeah, it sucks. I mean, that's why the advice I give on Twitter, and I posted the addresses for a while while I was sick, and I got a few thank yous for it, which was awesome to see, was I posted the addresses for a while of the retired players from the 40s and 50s, and people started to post their success stories, like Wally Westlake and Neil Berry and Bobby Chance and Bobby Doerr, and those guys like getting letters, you know, because they don't want to be forgotten. So that's just cool, you know. So that's the stuff I like. I mean, it's not for everybody. Some guys prefer prospects, but if you're going after prospects, just treat them like they're human beings, you know. And one argument a lot of angry collectors will use, like, well, you're just a minor leaguer, you shouldn't act this way. Like, who the hell are you?
Right. Amazing.
So that's what I don't like, but I think the hobby's a mess right now, and it's unfortunate, and it sucks.
And it's probably not going to get better either, unfortunately.
No, Twitter, eBay, and Facebook has made it much, much worse.
Correct. So, I don't know if this is going to be a lighter topic or not, unfortunately, but I did want to get into you a little bit. I've been talking to you on Twitter a little bit about, you know, good and bad poaching stories. I mean, you've told stories of trying to get players when they're, you know, when they've already been drafted and they're, you know, in A-ball. Well, do you have some good stories and some, you know, maybe some bad examples of poaching? What does that line go for you, or where is it okay versus where is it not okay? I just wanted to give you the floor for the topic.
So the vagaries of this, very vaguely. I mean, you can talk to anyone you want off the 40-man. If they're on the 40-man, it's a different set of rules that I can't get into. But if it's off the 40-man, if I see a player I like, I ask them if they have an agent. If they don't, it's easy. If they do have an agent, then I ask them who it is and if they're happy with them. And if they're happy with them, I leave it alone. I think I'm an outlier. I know people certainly don't respect that for me in any way, shape, or form, but I tend to leave it alone. And if it's somebody that I know, like an agent that I actually like, I've told guys to just stay with them no matter what people like me tell them. So, you know, that's kind of where I fall on it. I mean, if a guy has an agent that I know, I certainly tend to stay away from it. I mean, I do stay away from it. And if a guy is unhappy and is searching, and he's a prospect that I happen to like, you know, I do what anybody does. I try to meet with him and go from there. If it's personality fit, you just see what happens and then go from there. But you always, you know, need to be careful of the whole situation, because if the guy's, you know, there's always that situation where if a guy's meeting with agents and the guy's doing a really good job, you got to be careful, because then the kid's probably going to do it to you too. And then do you really want to represent the player?
Yeah, and how does that? And how do you make that judgment call? Because obviously, if they switch once, they're more likely to switch a second time.
Yeah, I mean, the thing for me is I've had guys switch to me. I've had a good retention rate. Usually guys who have fired an agent switch to me. I haven't lost very many of those guys. I'm actually more worried of the guys that have been with me from day one, because they don't know anything else. Guys who have had a bad agent and then switch to me don't leave. So
that's an interesting perspective. I hadn't thought of that. That's very interesting.
Yeah, so I, you know, it, you know, guys who have been in bad situations with like uncertified agents before and had stuff really messed up, they switched to me. I've had a good retention rate with those guys. But if a guy, if I meet like a name guy in the minor league and he's got a good agent and he's doing a good job and the guy still wants to fire him, I usually run from those guys no matter how good they are.
Yeah, because it's just going to be more trouble than it's worth, I guess, at the end of the day.
I mean, I went to a meeting. I went to a meeting with a player that was that had an agent. I went to a meeting with a player who had an agent this spring, because he was a mutual friend of a client of mine. And the first thing he said to me at the meeting was like, "I got to let you know from jump, I'm an equipment whore, and I need that stuff that's one of a kind that no one else has." I'm like, "Yeah, I don't want to represent you."
But at least he was straightforward. I'll give him that in a certain respect.
I guess. I mean, I'm glad I found that out first,
right.
But that was off-putting. So, I mean, that's a good way to find out if you want to work for someone or not.
Well, and you've developed a reputation, and I don't know the right word I want to use, but kind of a rehab, or, you know, when something's gone wrong, then players come to you. A problem solver,
yeah.
Maybe is the word is a good word.
I'm a cleaner. I'm a cleaner.
There's the word I'm looking for.
I'm Winston Wolfe and Mike Ehrmantraut. So.
How have you gotten that reputation, or is that just something you particularly like, or how has that developed?
I do like that. I don't like giving up on guys. I like fixing problems. I mean, I'm not the boyfriend who tries to fix all his girlfriend's problems and thinks he can fix all the broken women in the world. You know, I'm not that guy. but you know, my wife doesn't need any fixing. She's awesome. But you know, I certainly, you know, I like guys that are a challenge to a point. If everybody turned their back on a guy and he has ability, and people have turned their back on him, I like doing that. It happened with Jeffress. It happened with Kate Chapman, and there are other cases of it. But I don't like turning my back on good people who have ability. You know, I've told them point blank. There are guys that have been total train wrecks that I've tried to fix, and I told them, you know, they asked me if I wasn't a first rounder and, you know, I signed for $1,000, would you be doing this for me? And I'd be like, no, of course not. So you know, I'm honest and upfront about it, but I try to, you know, I try to help as much as I can. You know, there's one of the interesting things is I started scouting indie ball a little bit more, because I look at the list of guys that are sitting in indie ball and like, how do these guys not have jobs? And it's a victim of, they're victims of their agents kind of turning their back on them when they get released, and that just sucks. So, you know, I was really proud that I got Jay Chapman back to Milwaukee, you know, to an affiliated club, and I try real, you know, I'm not signing a bunch of guys from indie ball. It's not a good business plan, but there are guys in indie ball that I talked to that I took on as clients this year that I'm trying to get back because their agents just quit on them. So, you know, that sucks. You know, I don't like doing that. So, I do what I can with the right people.
Well, that makes sense. If I could shift directions a little bit, I do want to get a little more personal, if I could. You mentioned your wife.
Sure.
How does the job, I mean, your job is 24/7, I assume, 365. How does that affect, you know, having a relationship, and how does your wife handle all of this?
Exceedingly well. I don't know how. It's frustrating. You know, there's no designated time where I can just put my phone down and stop, but I mean, that's what it is. and that's the job. There's really no way I can get around it, and it's what I've been doing forever. So, I mean, she's great at dealing with that stuff, and goes to a lot of games, probably more than she should, for her own sake. but you know, it's tough. It's really hard. It's a hard job to maintain a personal life and to work.
And how long do you think you can do this job for? I mean, is this something you can see yourself doing at 60 years old?
Forever. I'm all in. I'm doing this till I die.
Well, that's good to hear. I guess you can't have any other philosophy once you get in, though, I assume.
I had an intern from the Mets last off at the winter meeting come up to me and ask me about becoming an agent or working for an agency. And I got to know him over the year in St. Lucie, because that's where I live. And, you know, he had asked me if he could work for me for a little while, try it out, see if he liked it, and or if it worked out, and then maybe jump in full time. And I'm like, can't do that. And he's like, what do you mean? And he had this fundamental lack of understanding of how the job and the business works. You can't try it out. You have to either do it or not do it. It's not to steal from Yoda, but you literally are all in, or you can't be an agent. You can't dabble in it, because how are you going to get hired by anyone if you're on a one-year contract with an agency and you go out to sign players and you tell them I have a one-year deal? How are you going to tell them you're going to be their agent forever? Because if you sign a player and you don't like it, that player, that's just, you know, you're not going to have an agent in a year. So, you know, you're either all in or you're out. So you just have to go for it. You can't dabble or it doesn't work, because you won't sign anyone.
Yeah, that makes a tremendous amount of sense when you put it that way. And since our last interview, I believe the New York Times ran a pretty, I think it was the Times, wrote a pretty interesting piece about you, discussing, you know, both your professional career and some of your health struggles. I don't know if you want to talk about that piece at all. I know it's general.
Oh, that was, yeah, Joe Lemire wrote it. It took 3 years to write, and it was good. I'm glad I came out with that. It's a really under-discussed topic. Bladder atrophy is under-covered disability, and not really a face on it, and I'm trying to be that face and doing more with Johns Hopkins and fundraising and trying to figure stuff out with them and trying to help them more with that, and eventually hopefully integrating baseball into it. So I'm trying to raise awareness with that through my story, and it's something that I really didn't talk about for a very long time, and now that I'm older, not really that big a deal, so I'm fine talking about it and helping other people with it. It got a good response, and you know, I think a million people read the story, which was insane, and a lot of important people were gracious enough to retweet it. Guys like Ken Rosenthal and Heyman and Jonah Carey and Patton and everybody retweeted it, so everybody in baseball got to see it, to the point where I think I was trending for a little while, and then that went away. But it was cool. It was cool. It came out a couple days before my surgery, and it was good morale boost. And then when I got out of surgery, a laundry list of emails I had to respond to. But it was good. I'm glad I did it.
And now, the most important question, how are you doing? How is your health?
I'm good. I got cleared a week ago. I actually was in Baltimore the day the riot started. And I got cleared, and the next day I was out of there, and then the riots exploded. So I just missed that fun time in Baltimore.
Yeah, I'm sorry I missed you. I was supposed to meet up with you, and unfortunately life got in the way. But
yeah, no problem. I'm just glad I got out of there before the riots.
Yeah, I was going to say, I'm glad you got out of there before the riots, and I'm glad to hear that your health is good, because that's obviously the most important.
I appreciate it. There was also a USA Today story that Bob Nightingale did on the juxtaposition of Jeremy Jeffress and Josh Hamilton that ended up pretty popular, and it was a good article. I enjoyed being a part of it.
I know you mentioned Jeffress in the last interview that we did, but I'd love for you to just talk about him again for those that didn't hear it. I mean, he's such an exceptional story that it deserves a second telling.
Yeah, you know, he had the two drug suspensions, and he'd been through his seizure issues, and that's all public, and he's beaten those odds, and he came back, and the article was about how the Angels were treating Josh Hamilton, and the juxtaposition of how the Brewers treated Jeremy. And that was a large reason why Jeremy went back to Milwaukee when he hit free agency instead of staying in Toronto or signing elsewhere. you know, I believe I had mentioned it, that Jeremy actually took a pay cut to sign with Milwaukee because we felt it had the right infrastructure for him to succeed, and we were right. And he's just taken off ever since, and now he's an established major league player, well on his way to getting arbitration and contract land, and he's playing great, he sounds great, and he's healthy, he's got his baby daughter, and his life's fantastic right now. It's pretty incredible. I mean, it's such a good story, and you know, I in the interview with Bob Nightingale, I gave a lot of credit to the Brewers because it never really, I mean, it never dawned on me because I'm just so used to telling people how great the organization was to Jeremy and has been with Jeremy with respect to his issues. I mean, there's been nothing but supportive the entire way through, and I can't imagine a ball club not being supportive of that or having gone through that. So I didn't want to comment on what the Angels and Josh Hamilton were going through because I'm not a part of that, so I don't really know what went on. But if what was being said publicly was true, I had said that it was unsettling because if that had happened to Jeremy, what was said publicly, Bob Nightingale asked me, would Jeremy still be playing baseball? I'm like, absolutely not. If the Brewers, you know, did to Jeremy what happened to Hamilton, it would have crushed him. So a lot of credit goes to Milwaukee for their infrastructure, and it kind of validated why we decided to go back there.
So I guess you don't want – the next question I was going to ask you is what you thought of the Hamilton situation. So maybe I can phrase it in a different way. How would you be advising –
I mean, I can't specifically talk about that, but I mean, it's unfortunate. I mean, it's a horrible disease, addiction, and the way it was handled, there's anonymity when it comes to the JDA, you know, the joint drug agreement, and the fact that they aired all of the dirty laundry and were leaking secrets allegedly, and the fact that it even came out was awful, and the comments that were made afterwards were even more troubling, and I, as an outsider, it just, it looked like a fiasco, and I just hope that Hamilton finds himself back in Texas. You know, it sucks. It's a horrible thing he's going through, and I hope he figures it out. And I know it's a self-inflicted issue, which makes it more difficult to empathize with and understand, but I've seen it up close and personal, and Jeremy beat it, and I know he offered words of encouragement to Hamilton, and I hope he gets his situation straightened out in Texas because he's a really good baseball player and seems to be a good dude.
Yeah, I have a mutual, I'll say acquaintance because we're not friends, but we have a mutual acquaintance with Josh Hamilton, and never has said a bad word, always says just what a phenomenal guy he is, and just, you know, he has a problem, and unfortunately, you know, that's difficult to, for society sometimes to separate, so...
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's one of the reasons I stuck with Jeremy all the years. Jeremy's one of the best people I've ever met. And, you know, people would ask me, why are you still dealing with this nonsense? And it's like, I'm not going to bail on him. Like, Jeremy's awesome.
Yeah, and there's something to be said for loyalty, particularly when the person's, you know, going through a tough time. But it's not something that's, I mean, it's self-inflicted, but it's not something that they're purposely doing to a degree. So.
Yeah, it's definitely not on purpose, I can tell you that.
Yeah. So one more personal question. The last time you were on the show, you mentioned the chances of a reality show. Are we any closer to that?
I think that got shelved for a while. The guy who was the producer needs more time to get it together. I don't know if it's – I doubt it happens this season, but I will revisit it before the winter meeting. And I was excited for it. I really wanted to do it in spring training, but it seemed a little rushed. And but I would have done it. And if we get something straightened out in the proper time, and it makes sense, I certainly would be interested in pursuing that. I think it'd be pretty cool to go through that. And you know, I like the guy who pitched the idea to me, and it just kind of stagnated for a little while. I know he had an issue with funding, you know, the idea. So. I think we're going to try it again at some point, but you know, during the season, I'm way too tied up to be doing anything that distracting. But you know, if it's around the winter meetings or you know, if it's spring training, I wouldn't mind doing something like that. But it's certainly not something I'd be able to do during the season.
Well, I think that would be a crazy documentary if they just followed you around for the 4 days of the winter meetings. I mean, I know the team stuff would be a little tough, but I think that would be phenomenal.
Oh, I would. It would just be me running around the lobby talking to people. I think that would be the best part. I wouldn't allow it to go. I mean, the teams wouldn't allow it either. But I wouldn't go to do any of the team stuff. But just the grind of just following me around following anyone around the winter meetings between going to the trade show, to the teams, to the lobby, to the media room, to the job fair, to just to, the vendors, it'd be interesting, especially given that it's, like I told you, 20-hour days. So, I mean, there are times where there have been winter meetings where I wouldn't get back to the hotel till 4 in the morning, and then I'd go back to the hotel at 7 in the morning. So
crazy.
It's something that's been underreported. You know, I know they overreport the actual news of what's happening, but the nuances of actually doing the winter meetings and being a part of it, I don't think anyone's ever covered that before, aside from to pat myself on the back that Baseball Prospectus article I wrote about my winter meetings journal, which I think up until the Transaction Monkey story was my best article.
I thought it was one of your best pieces, too. Maybe one of the best pieces BP ran last year. That was a terrific write.
So. It was funny. I was like, 12 o'clock here, 12:30 this, 12:45 this. On this, and it was like, that's really how it was. That's exactly what happened, and I was surprised at how many people. I take it for granted sometimes, I guess, but I can't believe how many people just didn't know it was like that.
Yeah, I think so many people think it's just a 9-to-5 gig, but no, it's the whole time things are moving, and when one thing happens, it has a chain reaction throughout baseball. It's really amazing.
And sometimes you see agents getting into fist fights, and then other times you see Brady Anderson doing the foot race down the lobby with Corey Schwartz from MLB Advanced Media.
I can't even imagine somebody challenging him, yet alone getting him to race. That's hilarious.
That was one of the funniest things that ever happened. And I told you, I helped facilitate that, right?
No, you didn't. I didn't know you were a part of it. I read this and heard the story from another source.
I wasn't a part of it. I was the main facilitator. I've known Brady since I was a kid. I was his bat boy in spring training a couple times. And every year at the winter meetings, we meet up and we all went to dinner one night. Will Carroll and Farron and Corey Schwartz, our usual, we do it every year. And at the table next to us was Brady Anderson, and this was 2 years ago, and I went over to see Brady, and I sat down with him for 15 minutes, and I told him I'd gotten married, and I brought him over to the table, and Corey was on the opposite side of the table talking to Farron, and Brady came over to meet my wife and talked to one other person for a couple minutes and was very nice, and then he left, and we were all talking about, after Brady left, how nice he was, and then Corey looks up and he goes, "What are you guys talking about?" It's like, "Oh, Brady Anderson, he's really nice." I'm like, "What do you mean?" Like, Brady Anderson just said hi to my wife. I've known Brady for years. And he gets up and runs out of the restaurant trying to find Brady, and he's like, "I've never met him. He's my white whale. He's my favorite. He hit 50 home runs for me in fantasy baseball one year. I can't believe I..." And this, God damn it, he wasn't paying any attention whatsoever to the situation. And then the next night they go to dinner at a different place, and Brady Anderson is sitting next to them again.
Oh,
and,
wow.
Corey went up to him, and they were talking, and Brady was talking, I think, to somebody. I think it was a woman. And
that's
Corey
not a
goes,
surprise.
By the way, Corey goes, "By the way, do you still do those foot races?" as a joke, and Brady goes, "Hold on a second." And then they go down the corridor where the Swan and Dolphin hotels connect, and he's like, "Look, all the cameras got to, got to put the cameras down, but we'll do it right now." And they did it. Brady ran it backwards and beat him backwards. Oh, yeah, but if it wasn't for me that first night, that never would have happened.
That's so funny. I didn't know you were a part of that story. That's great.
I was. I get angry every time I'm not mentioned in that story.
Yeah, because I mean, I know, we have a little relationship. I had no idea you were part of that story. I thought it was, like you said, Schwartz and the other guys. I thought Farron was more involved, frankly.
No way! I brought Brady Anderson to the table!
That's so funny.
Even Corey Schwartz told that story on some Baltimore blog, and I wrote in the comments section, "Thank you for mentioning me, idiot."
That's nice.
Yeah, and then he apologized, and then he put me in it. But, yeah, I facilitated that entire thing. I'm sorry.
Oh, that's so funny. Because that was one of my favorite stories from 2 years ago at the winter meetings. I wish I had known you were involved. I would have asked you about it the first time we talked.
Well, now you know. Yeah. That's how it happened. I brought Brady Anderson to the table. Corey didn't know he was there because he was talking to Farron. And he flipped out when he realized he missed Brady. And we all made fun of him. And then the next night, Brady happened. Like, what are the odds of that? Brady sat next
to him again. I mean, I know Uncle Mike is a very enthralling topic, you know, conversationalist, but how do you miss Brady Anderson coming to the table?
It was like, to be fair, there were 12 people, and Corey was the farthest away from where Brady was, but, you know, still, it was hilarious when he missed him. He was pissed.
Then all of a sudden he has his little fanboy moment where he runs out. That's so funny.
He was so angry. It was amazing.
Oh, wow. Well, Josh, thank you, man. I could pick your brain and talk stories and listen to you tell baseball
stuff. I'm sure I'll be on again.
Absolutely. Anytime you want. Standing invitation. When are we going to hear you?
I appreciate it.
When are we going to have you doing a podcast? We need to get you on air. When are you going to be doing something for BP or do a podcast? Or we need more Josh in our lives.
Before you called, I was in the middle of writing a column again. You know, I had the new one come out this past week about my 30th round draft pick that are close to making it to the big leagues. And I'm going to write another one today out of sheer elation of a former client that I shall not be named. And and then maybe you and I will get something going on a podcast, which will be fun.
That would be great. I'd love to do that. Just to, like I said, picking your brain and hearing stories is tremendous. So, Josh.
And I've got millions of them, so that would be good.
That would be awesome. Spot here for your plugs before I let you go. Twitter, Facebook, anything you want to plug?
Yeah, just a column at BP, and my name is, you know, on my Twitter page, it's at Joshua Kuznick, my name, JoshuaKuznick, and then my email is myname@AOL.com. For anyone who wants to email me, just please don't ask me how to become an agent or to be a source.
Yes. You know, not necessary. So, well, Josh, thanks so much for coming on. Happy birthday again. I hope you have
a great day.
Hopefully you get some good beer and hopefully some good food in you somehow. And
Somehow. There's got to be somewhere in St. Lucie.
Oh, there's got to. Yeah, there's plenty of places. I know Stewart's got some good spots to eat, too. So.
Yep, so I'll find somewhere. So I appreciate it.
And thank you so much, Josh. And I look forward to talking to you. And I hope to see you at the park sometime this spring. I haven't run into you yet.
Yeah, absolutely. We'll figure it out. Sorry we missed each other in Baltimore.
Yeah, that was my fault. I apologize about that again. So, Josh, keep doing great, and look forward to talking to you hopefully here in the next couple weeks.
Awesome. Thank you very much.
Sounds great. Thank you. Thanks again to Josh. That was my interview with him, Josh Kuznick, again. You can find him online at Twitter and Facebook and all that good stuff. He's a wonderful agent, great storyteller, and definitely a friend of the show. So look for more content with him hopefully in the future. We are done for this week. Bye for now.